For 41 years, Dave Ilbe represented Northwest Wisconsin in the U.S. House. For the last few years, he was one of the most powerful people in Wisconsin, chairing the U.S. House Appropriations Committee. But he retired now, and we've come to Wausau, his hometown, to the UW-Marathon County in the new Civic Engagement Center, which you helped, which you sponsored and maybe found a little money for, to talk about a fairly remarkable career. So, Congressman Ilbe, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you very much.
Can I just start with a broad question? You were there 41 years. When you left Congress in 2010, does Congress work anymore? Or is that an unfair question?
Well,
how well does it work, sir?
I mean, contrary to the myth of last year, this was probably the most productive Congress that I've ever served in. It passed a number of momentous pieces of legislation.
You were in the chair for health care.
Yep, you betcha.
Excuse me for interrupting.
And again, with all of the lies and myths that have been peddled about that, that is a superb national accomplishment, one of the greatest steps forward in the history of this country. I mean, we passed major reform of credit card processes,
yes,
so that consumers don't get jerked around by hidden costs every hour on the hour by those credit card companies. We passed major Wall Street reform legislation. And there are a whole list of things that we did. You can argue about whether you like them or not, but the Congress did produce, it did get something done, and we did what we said we were going to do on health care, on Wall Street reform, on credit card reform, and on a whole range of other issues.
So Congress, at least the last Congress that you were a part of, worked and worked well in terms of productivity.
It worked, it produced.
Yes.
But the way it works, I think, leaves a lot to be desired.
Okay.
Example, the Senate filibuster rule. Example, the ability of a single senator to prevent legislation from even being considered by putting an anonymous hold on that piece of legislation for any reason whatsoever. You can't just, it isn't that they just have the power to prevent action on a bill that's related to their gripe. It's that they can take anything on the landscape and shut it down until they get somebody to pay attention to them. That may satisfy their egos. It doesn't satisfy the public interest.
Okay. Well, quickly, before we get into some of these issues, because I want to ask about health care, how are you doing in retirement? I mean, or is that the wrong term?
Well, it's hard to tell the difference so far.
Has it, you've been so busy?
I mean, the first thing I had to do is to deal with the fact that I've got 41 years of files to deal with, and just trying to get those in a semblance of order so we could send them out to the university and the historical society.
Yes.
Has taken a lot of work. Then I had to take some 30 boxes of material I had to duplicate and take home so that I had my basic memory bank at hand if I needed to check something. And just going around the district thanking people for their support over the past 48 years, really, if you include my state legislative service.
Yes.
So it's I've been a little busy.
Have you been sorry at all that you didn't seek another term?
Not in the slightest.
Yeah.
I mean, I always told people that the purpose of being elected to a job like a member of Congress is to do something. And when we got done the things that I wanted done, I was frankly surprised at how happy I was to say, hey, we ought to turn this over to a new flock and see what happens. I'm not so sure I'm going to like the results of what that new flock will produce.
I was going to ask you about that. The 85 new GOP members?
I mean, 48 years is a long time to not have your own weekends, to not be able to go to your kids' recitals or your grandkids' recitals. It was worth it, but I think I'm entitled to do something else.
Well, let's talk about health care. Now, the U.S. House voted to completely repeal it, as you know. And my question is this. Can the new House Republicans starve it to death? Because you've heard their intent.
Well, let me first start by simply saying when you talk to me on health care, you are talking to somebody with a strong bias.
Because you were in the chair and when it passed.
Yes, I was, and I'm proud of that. But I remember when my sister was dying of cancer in Milwaukee, and I visited her for the last time, and she was in her hospital bed, and she said, "Dave, I hope I die by Friday." Oh. I said, "My God, why?" She said, "Because that's when our insurance runs out, and I don't want to leave Jack and the kids with any bills." And she died on Friday.
She did.
And I will never forget her statement, and I will. That just should not happen in this country. People should not be. They should not go bankrupt because they are unlucky on health care. They should not go bankrupt because some insurance company has a clever way to deny payment after people have paid for insurance for a lot of years. So I think it's disgraceful that this new Congress has repealed health care without having something in place to replace it. It's like jumping out of the plane and saying, "Don't worry, by the time we get down, we'll have a parachute." That's ridiculous. And I noticed that my successor, who on the campaign trail promised that he would not vote to repeal unless there was a new proposal in place, now marched into line with his party leadership and voted to throw out the baby with the bathwater, which means that 30 million people wouldn't get health insurance, which means we would lose billions of dollars in developing new nurses and physician's assistants and all the healthcare personnel we're going to need. It means you throw out lots of things. You can promise that you will fix something in the future, but you know there are going to be 435 people in that House who have something to say about whether that promise is ever going to be fulfilled or not. So it's I thought it was disgraceful that they repealed it before they had something else in place that was concrete, that was there.
Can they actually starve it to death? Cut off
they
funding?
They can try.
They can try.
But I mean, they can't repeal the basic law because this, I don't think the country will let them. But they can try. If they want to put politics and if they want to put ideology above everything else, they can try to slowly drain the system of its ability to meet the challenges of the new law. Example, if you're going to have 30 million more people with coverage, you have to have more doctors trained, you have to have more dentists trained, you have to have more nurses trained, you have to have more health professionals trained across the board. What possible public purpose would be served by squeezing the budget so that you cannot possibly train those additional healthcare professionals? If you did that, you would wind up, in fact, creating a system of rationing because if you don't have enough doctors and nurses and other professionals in the system, then people are going to be stuck a long time waiting to see a doctor if they need it. And there's no reason that should happen. But if they try to starve it by denying funding for those programs, they could cause that to happen.
For 41 years, you represented a district that is not a real upscale district, correct?
Right.
I mean, this is a hard-working area that scrambles for every dollar.
It's a work ethic district, you betcha.
How many of those 30 million without health insurance live in your old district, sir?
Well, I mean, Wisconsin is better off than most states on that score. But you still have, well over 100,000 people in this district who have severe health care coverage problems. And the problem isn't just access, it's affordability. Mm-hmm. One of the great things about this legislation, and one of the most difficult to achieve, was getting on the books proposals that will lead to the change in the way medicine is delivered to people in this country, so that in the end, doctors, for instance, will be reimbursed more on the basis of the quality of outcomes rather than on the basis
of, tests,
of the number of times that they do a procedure. And to their credit, Many people in the medical profession in Wisconsin fought to get that done. Ron Kind was our lead pony in those negotiations and did a terrific job, along with Betty McCollum from Minnesota and Steve Kagan and some others. And we've got to hang on to those changes because there are huge inefficiencies in the system. Medicare is being ripped off every day. We've got 8 Justice Department task forces at work today in this country going after Medicare fraud and abuse. You've got companies that are organized for the sole purpose of stealing people's identity and then using that stolen identity in order to make false claims to Medicare. And that costs the taxpayers a hell of a lot of money. And last year, for instance, if you take what we did the last 2 years, we doubled the financial resources available to go after that kind of nonsense. So you've got to retain all of those pieces, or you can guarantee that healthcare will be a failure.
In your last term, your last 2 years, you were working on healthcare. But when I talked to former Governor Doyle and State Senator Bob Jauch, who you were in contact with, they referred to you as the architect of the stimulus package. They said you were just swamped with that. Is that a correct characterization?
Well, I was the lead chairman.
You were
in putting that package together.
You were putting it all together.
But there were a number of pieces to that package. You had the revenue piece. You had you had the spending piece. You've had the regulatory piece. A lot of different pieces. If I had had my way, that stimulus package, and this is heresy, I know, but if I'd had my way, it would have been a lot bigger.
How much bigger?
And you can't, as the Republicans are now doing with the budget, saying, oh, we're going to cut $100 billion. They pick a number out of the air, and they want reality to fit their press release. What you have to do is to figure out what's the size of the problem that you are trying to counteract. And the fact is that when George Bush left office, he recognized that the financial system was falling apart. It's not very often I say something good about George Bush. But Bush started the effort to correct what was happening in the country by pushing through the most unpopular piece of legislation that I think the Congress considered in my lifetime, and that was the TARP program.
Troubled Asset Relief.
Yeah, the so-called bailout bill. Now, he didn't, I can't speak to his reasons, but in the Congress, we didn't support that request of George Bush's because we were in love with the Wall Street boys. We did it because we knew that they had screwed things up so badly and brought the world so close to a financial collapse that if we didn't do something to stabilize the situation, we would have had a total collapse of the financial system in the world, and you could have had 20-25% unemployment coming at you. When the Secretary of the Treasury called the Speaker of the House and said, Madam Speaker, we've got a problem. I got to talk to you right away because the financial system is freezing up and businesses in this country aren't going to be able to get any credit. They're going to be laying off people massively. And Nancy said, well, why don't you come down and talk to me next Tuesday? And he said, I'm sorry, but by then it may be too late. We've got to do this now.
So that's what...
And that's what triggered George Bush.
That's what could have happened had you and other leaders not acted on TARP bailing out the auto industry
and when we did it, we knew it would be the most unpopular action we'd taken. But I also think it was one of the most important votes that I ever cast, and I'm pleased that I voted for it. And most of that money has now been turned back to the federal government. Nobody knows that, but almost 90% of that money has now been returned to the federal government. So that was the first piece.
Yes, sir.
You had to first stabilize the financial situation. And that's very similar to what Franklin Roosevelt had to do back in the 30s, when the very first thing he did when he took office was to close the banks, so that when they reopened, the public had more confidence in them, just like Obama and Treasury Secretary Geithner running a stress test on all of the banks to see whether or not they were financially sound or whether they needed to be taken over by somebody who was. That was the first step. The second step was to try to respond to the fact that we were facing a $3 trillion hole in the private economy because of the total collapse of consumer demand. And so when Obama's people first came down and talked about a stimulus package, they told me that his economic team told me that they thought they needed needed a package far bigger than the one that they finally produced. Mm-hmm. They were talking about a $1.4 trillion package to deal with a $3 trillion hole. And they decided very quickly that that number was so large you couldn't get it through the Congress, so they scaled it back. And then to get support from the Senate, they had to scale it back even further. And so it wound up being about half the size that it needed to be. But even if it had been the full $1.4 trillion, that alone would not be enough to repair the economy, because you had a lot of other problems. You had runaway Wall Street. These guys still going after their bonuses, despite the fact that they just ripped off the country. Mm-hmm. You had the housing problem, which needed to be addressed, and which is the most complicated of all of the problems to solve.
Subprime
and
issues.
And so,
foreclosures.
Only someone who is incredibly ignorant or naive about the economy would think that a simple spending program would be enough to turn the unemployment numbers around. That needed to be a powerful stroke, but you had to have other actions occur after that, and over time they are, but much more slowly than I would like to see, and often it's because of the obstruction that we've had to face in the Senate.
Packages like those, without a doubt, added to our national debt, which is now part of the debate.
Sure.
And one of the reasons I asked earlier if Congress still works is because we're funding the federal government through these temporary, there's no permanent budget bill. As you know, you've got to come back and raise the debt ceiling. So that's the other side of the spending. But what you say, had you not acted, it would have been disaster, cataclysm.
Well, absolutely. There's no question. But the question is, what do you do about it now? Yeah. Obviously, over the long haul, we need to get the deficit in order. I will not take any lectures from any Republican member of the House on fiscal responsibility after what I've wrestled with them on ever since the Reagan days. I mean, when President Reagan came in, we had never had a deficit larger than $70 billion. When he left, that deficit was approaching $200 billion. He promised that we could double the defense budget and cut taxes by one-third and balance the budget. And George Bush Sr. correctly called that voodoo economics, mm-hmm. and it was. Mm-hmm. Then when Clinton came in, we passed the legislation which turned the country around and eliminated the deficit over about a four-year time period. Yeah. That cost Peter Barca in this state his seat, because he had guts enough to vote for that package, knowing that it was probably going to cost him his seat. But that was an act of high statesmanship on his part, and we passed it by one vote, with not a single Republican vote. And they all predicted financial Armageddon, and instead, over time, it led to a balanced budget. Now, to be fair, George Bush Sr. started the process of deficit reduction. Mm-hmm. Couldn't get all the way there, but Bill Clinton finished the job. But then George Bush Jr. came in and reversed what Clinton did, passed $2 trillion worth of tax cuts, primarily aimed at high-income people, paid for with borrowed money, got us into two wars, paid for with borrowed money, and then passed a prescription drug bill, again paid for with borrowed money. Yep. And that's where the deficits came from, until the economy collapsed. And that made the deficits even larger. So what we tried to do is to recognize that over the short haul, you needed to have deficit spending in order to give the economy a boost. but that once the economy started to grow at an acceptable rate, you then have to do what we did under Clinton, which is to squeeze the deficit down again so that it drops continually as a percentage of our national income so that it doesn't leave future generations in hock. So the question is not whether we need deficit reduction. We certainly do long term. The question is when it needs to start so that you don't by accident do what FDR did in 37 when he ended the government stimulus program too soon, and the economy went into another nosedive, and it took another 3 years to come out of it.
The recent debate over the Bush tax.
We've got to do that.
Yeah.
And then we've got, so the question is not only is when we start that downward trend, and how we do it. Are we going to do it in ways that will simply stifle the economy for the next 10 years, or are we going to make room in that economy and make room in that budget for things in science, in education, tax credits for jobs, so that we are making the right investments mm-hmm. so that you add to the country's ability to grow and create jobs?
Part of this debate is over the Bush tax cuts. Now, they've been pushed out. Do you think they'll be one of the major issues in the 2012 presidential campaign? Because President Obama said, here's what I want, but he was forced to accept something else.
I don't think we ought to be arguing yesterday's issues in the next election, but what we should be arguing is what's the future going to look like? And I would ask people, do they really believe that we can continue to fight two wars? Do they really believe we can continue to provide huge, supersized tax cuts for millionaires? Or do they think that providing a tax cut for people who make over $250,000 a year, do they really think that's our highest economic priority? Or should we scale back on those tax cuts in order to bring down the deficit faster and to enable us to make other needed investments? I mean, we're not talking about eliminating tax cuts for people over 250 grand. We're talking about capping the size of those tax cuts mm-hmm. so that they aren't getting 20 times as much as somebody making 50 grand.
Your thoughts on the last election, especially the emergence of the Tea Party. Is that a one-time phenomenon, or is that going to be part of America's political dialogue?
You've had movements like that that are... every time we've had severe economic problems in the history of the country, and that movement is two-headed. Part of that movement is as a genuine response to people's fear and anger and concern about the direction of the country and the squeeze that they feel in their own lives and they see their family and their neighbors experiencing. But there's also an artificial aspect to that because you have some of the richest people in this country, the Koch family, for instance. Their combined assets, I think, are around $30 billion. Hmm. Not bad. Yeah. But they have invested a lot of money into operations like some of these groups that have been helping to organize the Tea Party because they want two things, and two things only. They don't want to have to pay nearly as much in taxes as they're paying today, and in my view, they're paying too little mm-hmm. Up in that bracket. And they also don't want the government to be regulating their business conduct. The Koch brothers run the oil and gas pipeline businesses, and they have had all kinds of suits brought against them for actions that they've taken in essence, maximize profits at the risk of public safety and the health of their workers. And if you've seen The Wizard of Oz, you know what the old gent looks like behind the curtain pulling those levers, and that's what you have with the Koch brothers, with the Scafies, with the Coors, some of the big names in American finance. Those families. They act as though they're all followers of Ayn Rand, philosopher who put selfishness above all other virtues, and they certainly exhibit that every day.
On the other side, George Soros funds some of those causes on the other side.
Yes.
But I want to ask...
Which gives us maybe one-tenth the leverage on the progressive side that you have on the conservative side.
I want to ask you where you were when you heard about the shootings in Tucson and your reaction to that, sir.
Gabby Gifford is a terrific human being. I mean, I just loved her. I was simply trying to sort out some of my papers.
Okay.
When I heard it happen, I turned on the TV after I got a phone call from a friend, and who told me what had just happened.
Was this one mentally ill person, or should you go back to the dialogue, the harsh rhetoric on both sides, sir?
Both.
Really?
I mean, we have no evidence that anything happened here except that a deranged person went off the deep end and ruined a lot of people's lives. But that doesn't mean that there aren't others out there who, because of a loose screw somewhere, wind up getting the wrong message from the kind of language that we use. When you tell the American people that your opponent is a traitor or a communist or a socialist or a fascist, when you tell them that there is a conspiracy theory that the president of the United States is illegitimate because he was not born an American, when you peddle this nonsense, deranged people can get the wrong message. And let me tell you, I have been on the receiving end of enough threats during my time in public life. You know, I've had a guy with serious problems come at me with a knife. I've had people threatened. When Gaylord Nelson was in the Senate and the Posse Comitatus was riding high,
mm-hmm.
They announced that they were going to perform a citizen's arrest on Gaylord and me and try us for treason and hang us. And I was laughing about it until one of the FBI people came in and said, "Don't laugh, they mean to do it. We've got a guy on the inside of the operation." And it took an awful lot of law enforcement personnel to get Gaylord and me in and out of the NFO convention in Marshfield years ago. I had an altercation in Clark County with these posse guys. I mean, these guys weren't just talking about stashing automatic rifles. They were, they were talking about stashing bazookas, for God's sake.
Well, in the last 3 weeks, there's been a new discussion of the word civility. Is that necessary that we have more civil dialogue politically in America, Congressman?
You're not going to take politics out of politics, and you're not going to take passion out of politics. I wouldn't want to. Well, this country wouldn't exist if our founding fathers hadn't been passionate about certain ideals. But the fact is, there's always more than one way to skin a cat.
Mm-hmm.
And in the long run, we're all served if we try to recognize that our opponents are not our enemies, and that people may have wrong ideas, but that doesn't make them defective politically, personally. This goes in cycles.
It does.
When I first was elected to Congress, the hating was coming from the left. A lot of people were opposed to the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
and I would say that in the Congress, about one-third of them were so vehemently opposed to that war that they hated Lyndon Johnson, they hated Richard Nixon, they hated John McCormick, the Speaker of the House, and they, even if you agreed with them on the subject, if you had a different approach to it in terms of tactics, somehow you were morally defective. Now, most of those people are gone now, but they've been replaced by that same kind of hard-headed nonsense on the right. And that has been aided and abetted intentionally, in my view, by people like Newt Gingrich.
Was that when was that the period that Congress really got so partisan?
I think it started in 1978.
78?
When Gingrich got elected, and he started holding schools for candidates to teach them how to use pejorative language to discredit their opponents personally. And they sent out this list.
So this was a list from Gingrich to candidates.
Yeah, okay. And to other political activists. It said, use this list in writing speeches, direct mail, brochures, flyers, newspaper ads, news releases, door-to-door campaigning. Anywhere you need to talk about your campaign. And then they talk about language as a mechanism of control. And they urge people to use these words when they are describing their opponents. Sick, lie, betray, traitors, corruption, radical, corrupt, shame, disgraceful, bizarre, cheat, steal, anti-family, anti-flag, anti-child.
The whole Andy went up then.
Yeah.
I appreciate
it. I mean, that certainly isn't the only thing that caused it. The other, I think what has also contributed to it is that as politics has become more nationalized and more competitive, I mean, when I was first elected, most members didn't have pollsters. They certainly didn't have national consultants. Mm-hmm. Today, almost anybody with half a race does.
Yeah.
And so they get this advice. It leads to much more sharp rhetoric. It leads to much nastier TV ads. And the result, I would ask you, if you are a voter in a small town like this one, how do you get enough information to make an intelligent choice about who you vote for when you see these TV ads, 30 seconds, slashing Nancy Pelosi, slashing George Bush Jr., just going for the juggler, taking a phrase that a candidate has uttered and totally twisting the content, taking it out of context, and ruining people's ability to make intelligent, thoughtful choices about who they want to support.
Where should voters get rational, nonpartisan info?
They should get rational information from the candidates.
Okay.
They should get...
And not be framed up by the special interest groups?
They should get basic unbiased information as much as possible from the news media and other watchdog organizations. The problem is, as you know, that the news media is in big trouble financially. Thanks to the internet, newspapers are being devoured. And so if you have a community newspaper that 20 years ago had 10 or 15 stories about what's going on in national politics, today you're lucky if they have two. Mm-hmm. They don't have the space, they don't have the dollars, and so the public has a terrible time finding sources of information. And then you go on television, and what do you have? You got Fox News. If you're conservative, you watch Fox News. If you're a liberal, you watch MSNBC. If you don't know what you think, you watch CNN.
Okay.
And you don't ever have your own ideas challenged.
I see.
So what has happened in politics is that you get 10 liberals together, they talk to each other, and they think that the world agrees with them. You get 10 conservatives yep. who talk with each other, and they think alike, and they think they've taken a national public opinion poll, when in fact they aren't having their own ideas challenged and cross-fertilized. And so when you become convinced that the other side doesn't have a single thing to say about something that's correct, then that makes it easier to go after people personally as well as politically. And that spoils the whole system.
You served with 8 presidents. Can we talk about, let's run them down.
Sure.
When you came to the U.S. House, President Nixon.
Strange man, very able man. He went out in disgrace being impeached. He along with Joe McCarthy, has a huge share of the responsibility for creating the nastiness of the McCarthy era. And obviously he had a paranoid approach to politics, which mm-hmm. led him to try to wiretap the opposition. But he also did some very good things. I mean, he did make possible having at least a somewhat civil relationship with China.
Mm-hmm. Open those doors.
Which we need, even though I'm very unhappy with our trade policy toward China and our human rights policy with China. We do have to have a relationship with them. It was under Nixon that Gaylord Nelson and Scoop Jackson and Ed Muskie and others were able to pass the Clean Water Act and the Clean create EPA, I mean, and buttress the Clean Water Act, things mm-hmm. like that. Nixon also proposed a health care system that would have gone further than the system that we finally passed last year. I was for what Nixon was trying to do, but that was beaten by a weird coalition of the far left and the far right, who for opposite reasons blocked Nixon's package. And I mean, Nixon tried to get that done, so did a number of other presidents, going back to Harry Truman, going back to Roosevelt, really. And it's a tragedy that it took some 70 years to get it done.
I heard a story that you went up to the late President Ford and told him of all the presidents you worked with, he was the best, and Jerry yeah. Ford said you must have had pretty thin pickings.
He came to the House floor about 2 years ago, or 3 years ago now, I guess. And I went up to him. I said, Jerry, I just finished a book, and you're going to be shocked to understand that I evaluated all the presidents, and I ranked you the best. And he put his hand on my shoulder. He said, damn slim pickings, wasn't it?
So you liked him? You thought he was effective? He was a man of the house from Michigan?
He was an institutionalist. Okay. He understood the importance of preserving institutions in order to preserve the system. And I certainly didn't agree with his economic policies, but he did the two things that needed doing at the time. They may not seem very big now, but they were huge then. Number one is he restored the American, average American's confidence in the decency of people running the government. Mm-hmm. He was a very decent man. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he had really quality people in those agencies. You might disagree with them, but they were experienced. They understood how these things worked. They weren't just theoreticians. Who are trying to make reality fit their theories instead of the other way around.
I see.
I just thought the way he went at governance was decent. And he practiced politics, he's like Mel Laird. I mean, he practiced politics in a civil, decent way. He also, at the time, I opposed what he did when he pardoned Nixon, mm-hmm. but he was right to do that because that got Nixon off the front pages and out of people's heads so that the country could move forward.
The nation was able to move on.
Yeah, and I opposed what Ford did at the time, but I was wrong.
One-term President Carter, sir?
He was a very talented, very informed man who, from the day one, gave off the signals that that it was a burden that he found it hard to bear and that he just really didn't like politics very, very much.
Wow.
And I think that made it hard for him to govern because it made it easier for people to think that he wasn't up to the job, when in fact he was a very tough-minded person. You would never have had a Camp David settlement under any other president that I worked with. Carter was the only person who could bring that off because he was driven by a strong moral imperative mm-hmm. as well as a strong rational understanding that this was in the interest of both the United States and the two partners to the agreement in the Middle East.
He was an incredibly clean,
decent politician in the way he practiced politics.
The two terms of President Reagan, sir?
Reagan was a charming man, personally, who I think did terrific damage to this country long term, because he is the guy who started this rhetoric that the government was the enemy. Mm-hmm. The government is against you, mm-hmm. and he made it easier for people in this country who don't have any answers, who simply want to work off people's frustrations, to be heard more than they otherwise would be. He also pushed through the budgets, which quadrupled our national debt. And at the time, when he proposed his budgets, which wound up just exploding the annual deficits, Henry Royce from Wisconsin, yes, Mo Udall, and I sponsored the progressive alternative to Reagan's budget. We got beat, but we got a majority of Democrats supporting it. But Reagan's, and David Stockman, Reagan's budget director, in the end pointed out that they knew the numbers were wrong. They were just using these numbers as an excuse to drive down the tax rate for the top income earners in this country. Wow. He admitted that in that famous Atlantic Monthly article. And it did a lot of damage to the budget of the country. And it really took a combination of George Bush Jr. and Bill Clinton to reverse that problem.
The first President Bush, George Herbert Walker?
I liked him a lot, personally. And he consulted widely. When he went into the war in the Middle East, the first one, he would pull people down to the White House on a regular basis, mm-hmm, broadly, and talk to them about it. And he also understood how personal relationships could help make government work. Just little things like, I mean, he was a prolific note writer, and thank you. He produced more thank yous notes than I bet you any five presidents put together. Mm-hmm. That may not seem important, but in a conflict-ridden atmosphere like politics and governing is, it helps to smooth the rough edges off things. And I think his economic policies were not all that hot, he did manage well the collapse of the Soviet Union. I was chairman of the Foreign Operations Subcommittee at the time, so we worked very closely together with his team in putting together our aid packages for Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And we also, working with Jim Baker, were able to reach an agreeable end to the war in Nicaragua, which Reagan had practiced under the table, in my view, illegally. And so I have fond memories of Bush Sr.
Now, you've mentioned President Clinton earlier. What do you want to add about his legacy, sir?
Well, he came in and immediately faced up to the biggest problem we had, which is these huge deficits. And so he produced a package which over time took us from Reagan's large deficits to Bush began the process of cutting those deficits down, and then Clinton finished the job. And so at one time Alan Greenspan was at the Federal Reserve, was actually expressing concern that we would be able to wipe out our entire national debt, and then he didn't know how you were going to get people to buy government bonds. Well, obviously George Bush Jr. took care of that problem with his misguided economic policies.
You've been a pretty good critic of Bush too. Was there any area that you did go along with him, agree with him? Or do you just think he was a Class A mismanager, Congressman?
I think that he was needlessly confrontational. When he took over, my first meeting with him, I thought, you know, I'm going to like this guy. He's got a good sense of humor. He's not too full of himself. And then 9/11 hit.
Yes.
Now, he did a superb job in New York rallying the country at Ground Zero. But shortly thereafter, you will remember, we got hit with arsenic on the Hill.
Yeah.
Feingold's office and others. And so Capitol Hill got closed down. So I called Bill Young, who was then the Republican chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and I was a senior Democrat. I said, Bill, why don't we go from agency to agency and simply get from the horse's mouth what they think they have to have immediately in order to respond to this problem. Mm-hmm. So we went to the CIA, the FBI, National Security Agency, and all the rest, and asked them what they need. And we got a list, and we had it staffed out, and we called it and called it, and the staff brought it to Bill and me, and then we said, okay. And they said, this is as much as we can in conscience cut. We just have to have this. We said, okay, now go back and cut this in half.
I see.
So that there's no garbage in it.
Yeah.
And then we went down to the White House and talked to Bush. We expected to simply report to Bush what we thought needed doing. He'd accept some. He'd toss some aside. And he walked into the room. And before we could say anything, he said, no, I understand some of you want to spend more than I do on Homeland Security. But he said, my budget director here tells me that we have more than enough money in the budget for that. And so I want you to know, if you add a dollar to my Homeland Security budget, I'll veto the bill. Now I've got time for a few comments and I'm out of here.
Really?
I've got another meeting. So Bob Byrd
imposed it on you. Yeah.
Yeah. So Bob Byrd responded and told him what he thought of that approach.
Yeah.
Ted Stevens, conservative Republican from Alaska, said, Mr. President, we're not trying to have a fight with you. We've already agreed if there's anything on this list you don't want, we'll toss it. But some of this needs to be done. And when it came my turn, I said, Mr. President, I've been coming down here for 30 years. It's the first time I've ever had any president tell me his mind was closed before the subject was even open. And I said, you know, since you're taking such a hard-nosed approach, I'm going to ask you four questions about federal installations that we've been told by your own security people are gravely at risk of terrorist attack. Their words, not mine.
Yeah.
And I want to know if you've been briefed, and if you have, I want to know what you've been told. And it was obvious he hadn't been briefed.
He had
on
not
him.
Been briefed.
And we didn't expect him to. Presidents are busy. But I did that to try to show him that there were things he needed to know that he didn't know. And I walked out of that meeting, and I had been thinking of retiring after that year. I'd been there a long time, and I'd been thinking of retiring. And I walked out of that room determined to outlast him, because I was so shocked that on something that called for bipartisanship as much as Homeland Security, mm-hmm. he threw it out the window without even hearing what we had
without
to say.
Without even being briefed.
And I thought, if that's the way he's going to govern, we need people around here to try to limit that. And so I told Dick Gephardt as he left the room, I said, Dick, that man right now on this issue is the biggest security risk in the country, because he doesn't know what he doesn't know, and evidently his staff doesn't have guts enough to tell him.
How much safer are we as Americans 9.5 years later?
I don't think we know.
Okay.
We have invested a lot of money, some of it well, some of it not well. I think that we are dealing as effectively as we can, given what limited opportunities we have to protect ourselves,
mm-hmm.
because if you're a terrorist, all you have to do to succeed is to succeed one out of 100 times. If you are trying to stop terrorism, in order to succeed, you got to succeed 100 times out of 100. Those are tough odds.
Yeah.
So you need to have a reasonable risk assessment. But also, we need to be following policies in foreign affairs which do not gratuitously make more enemies for us than are necessary. We need to recognize that when we have a very large footprint in the Middle East for as long as we have, we are bound to become more controversial in that region of the world, and that makes it easier for people like bin Laden and others of his ilk to convince other frustrated people that somehow the West and American values are really the cause of their own problems. And that's nonsense, but it makes it easier to do that. And our presence can serve as a recruiting tool for other terrorist groups. And so I think the best way to limit the threat is to make certain that we are not having a bigger footprint than is necessary in some of these places around the world, because that just makes us a sitting duck for somebody else's frustration.
Let me ask about President Obama this way. What do you think he has to do to get reelected in 2012, sir?
Well, he's run for president. I haven't, so I'm sure he has a better idea than I do. I think what he has to do in policy terms, you can have all the ideas in the world that sound good and they can get you good headlines on the day you pass the bills. But if they don't work, the proof is going to be in the pudding. And if they don't work, and if they haven't helped create better conditions, then all your great ideas aren't going to get you much politically. And so I think substantively, he's going to have to be very aggressive in pushing policies that increase the capacity of the country to put people back to work. And that means we've got to make the right investments so that we, number one, we've got lots of people in this country who are looking for work, but who don't have the skills that are needed to fill the job vacancies that are available,
yeah.
Number one. And that's why education, technical education, math, science, we need strong investments there.
We recently ranked 23rd internationally in the world. And you've got a chart on that issue, don't you?
Yes, I do. We fancy ourselves as providing equal opportunity for kids in this country to go to college.
Yeah.
That's bull gravy. I've spent my life trying to strengthen support for education, but this chart shows everything.
Okay.
If you take the 20% of kids in the eighth grade across the country who are the highest achievers, the kids who have had the most success academically, the top 20% of their class as eighth graders, and you take a look at what happens to college graduation rates for those kids.
Yes.
If those kids come from families that are in the 25% richest families in the country, they have a 74% chance of graduating from college
or university. Okay.
Yeah. If they are from the poorest families, the poorest quarter of families in this country, they have a 29% chance of graduating from college. And if they come from the middle half, it about splits the difference.
What does that tell you, sir?
That tells me that while we talk about having equal opportunity, we really don't. We do not provide nearly enough help to these kids and these kids to go to college. These are kids who are academic stars but can't go to college because they can't afford it or because their families have problems. And we are not doing a very good job of recognizing the tremendous loss of resources represented by this. I mean, this is an immoral result. It's also a suicidal result from the, in terms of academic, in terms of economic competitiveness around the world.
Right. Fascinating.
That's a huge talent pool.
And that's as
that
of
we're
when,
not going to be able to
which
take
year? Is that of 09 or something, sir?
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask you one other question. Did you ever consider running for the U.S. Senate? All your experience in Congress?
I did once. Gaylord Nelson did not want to run in 1980.
Yep.
And he asked me to run. And I said, I thought about it for about 2 days. And I said two things. I said, number one, I wasn't going to do it because I didn't want to have to raise the money that it would take.
Okay.
And secondly, I said, I just have my doubts about the functioning of the Senate as an institution.
Do you have more doubts now than ever?
Much more.
In light of the filibuster?
In those times, the filibuster was used rarely.
Mm-hmm.
It was used on matters of high importance. They were real filibusters.
I see.
Not just threats to shut the place down. But today, I mean, my God, Mitch McConnell and the Republican minority use virtually every issue to justify a filibuster. And it became obvious, and McConnell said it after the election, when he said his number one priority is simply to defeat
President Obama.
I mean, when I started in politics, you at least maintained the veneer of civility. And you, at least for the first year, you thought you could probably get some things done before you entered another election year. But before you've even been sworn in for the next term,
mm-hmm.
to say my number one goal is to beat the other guy and to take the president down, that demonstrates that what McConnell has been doing with the minority in the Senate is to simply obstruct every single action that they had the ability to obstruct. It is amazing to me that the president has, gritted his teeth and borne it as well as he has, because there's no question that Obama faces the most determined political opposition that I have seen in my lifetime. And that isn't just in the United States Senate, or McConnell's mission every day is to bring down Obama. But it's also when you see that the president has arrayed against him an entire news network like Fox News. I mean, FDR never had to take on a massive national news network every day. Mutual may not have been a good friend,
mm-hmm.
but they at least maintain the veneer of objectivity. Today, the view that journalists are supposed to be objective has largely gone out the window on television, and so you get virtually every issue Fox News will twist in order to attack Obama, so he has a much tougher job of governing in this atmosphere than any president I've ever seen.
Well, I do want to respect your time, so I've got only a few more questions. I want to ask you about three institutions in Washington, the emergence of K Street, the lobbying corps. You've just seen it explode, right?
It has.
It's a city now.
Well, I mean, everybody has a right to petition their government for redress. And everybody has lobbyists. Teachers have lobbyists. News agencies have lobbyists. The business has lobbyists. Labor has lobbyists. There's nothing wrong with having lobbyists. What's wrong is when you wind up skewing the system, and when you have such huge incentives, so that both parties wind up shifting their performance in the direction of policy that will satisfy the economic elite in this country.
I see.
In the last, If you take a look at what happened in history, 1929, you had a huge percentage of our national income going to the wealthiest 1 or 2% of people in this country, and the rest of the country was getting table scraps. That changed substantially after FDR came in, and so we wound up at the end of World War II. We were a pretty egalitarian society. But since that time, we've had the biggest transfer of wealth up the income scale in the history of the universe. And that means that today, again, the top 2% own as much in this society as they did in 1929, and everybody else has table scraps. The last 6 years of George Bush's administration, over 90% of all of the income growth in the country mm-hmm. went into the pockets of the wealthiest 10%. And then you wonder why people are joining the Tea Party and getting angry. When Tea Party people came to me squawking about what was happening with issues like this, my response was, what took you so long? You know, I've been angry about this for more than 10 years. What on earth took them so long?
There's two other parts of Washington. They're kind of related. How have you seen the Washington Press Corps change over your 41 years? And what about these Sunday talk shows? Are they an echo chamber?
We've lost a tremendous amount of talent in the news area. There are over, I was told that there are over 300 local newspapers that used to have a correspondence covering Congress who don't anymore.
More than 300.
Because of the financial impact that's hit the news profession. And that really, really hurts. Because you lose the ability of people to understand what's going on in the Congress. When you see some of the major newspapers in this country continually offering buyouts and you see their best senior reporters leave and they're replaced by people who have no institutional memory. Mm-hmm. If you're going to cover the Congress, you need to understand what's happened in that place over a 10 and 15-year period. And you need to be able to spend enough time and get involved in enough depth so that you can evaluate the horse flesh. You've got to be, reporters have to be able to form sound judgments about the integrity and reliability of each individual member of Congress. And given the overworked nature of the press corps today, it's very hard for them to do that.
Sunday talk shows, your quick impression of that?
Same old stuff every other Sunday. If you don't know what to do on CBS, you invite John McCain. If you don't know what to do on ABC, you have Cokie Roberts and George Will. Nothing wrong with those people,
but predictable.
I mean, what happens is the same people come, and if they're going to be questioned, they call six experts in town. Say, tell me what's going on here. And so they become instant experts on subjects that they don't know a hell of a lot about, to be frank about it. And if you bring people on who do know a lot about it, nobody knows who they are, and so nobody watches the show.
I see.
So it's they're sort of stuck in the same.
You've been a part of a dialogue.
We are.
You've been a part of a dialogue of four wars: Vietnam, Persian Gulf, Iraq, Afghanistan. Which do you think most damaging, or is that the wrong question? Most. Help me, the most, well, the war that is that shaped or is shaping our nation the most.
I think if you're from a family who lost someone in those wars, whichever war you lost somebody in
obviously
is the war that's the most damaging to you.
Yes, sir.
But, when I got there, I was very much against the Vietnam War. But I came from Mel Laird's district. Mel Laird was the Secretary of Defense. I had a great deal of respect for him. And Nixon, after all, had inherited the problem. And so what I said was, much though I have misgivings about this war, I'm going to wait a year before I start voting against it just to give Nixon a chance to show what he can do. And that's what I did. I stuck to my word, even though I didn't like it, because I hated that war. Mm-hmm. People were dying. That's what I think people should have done on the health care bill. I mean, if they said that they weren't going to vote for something until something was in place, they should have stuck to that, because people elected them with that reassurance. I think the most unnecessary war was the war in Iraq.
Iraq.
Because the justification for that war was, well, they hit us. Iraq didn't hit us. Al-Qaeda hit us. Iraq didn't have a blessed thing to do with it. And most, it's astonishing to me that most people in this country still don't know that. But I was out at CIA headquarters getting a report from them on the search for bin Laden. And I was watching what the Predators were, the pictures the Predator aircraft were sending back to us in real time. And I was listening to these CIA guys who were furious with George Bush because he had diverted half of their resources from the search for bin Laden to preparing to go to war in Iraq. And that's how we lost our chance to get him, because the focus that we had on getting him evaporated. And we also took our eye off the ball in Afghanistan.
Do you think
that allowed the Taliban to rebuild? So I think going into war in Iraq was the most unnecessary war.
Do you think the war in Afghanistan's winnable, sir?
It can be winnable if you define winnable in a very limited way. But you have to stretch the meaning of the English language to do that. I hope to God that they're going to have more success than I think they will. I think our chances of producing a government that is any more stable than the government that was left there by the Russians when they left are pretty slim.
You have a legendary temper. Was that's just who you are. That wasn't an act designed to get some political leverage, correct?
I think that a lot of people misinterpret passion for temper. Am I passionate? You bet. Do I get angry sometimes? You bet. Do I sometimes lose my temper? You bet. But I've seen lots of people in that place lose their temper a lot more than I do. And let me say something else. Sometimes, if you don't get mad about something, you don't know what's going on. When you see the way the middle class has been ripped off, when you see the way workers who work their heart out for a company for 30 years can wake up one day and see that the company's been moved to Mexico and nobody's doing anything about it in your eyes. I mean, if you don't get angry at that, what on earth are you going to get angry about?
Is there one vote over 41 years you'd like back?
Oh, yeah, there are a number of votes.
The one
that I'd most like to have back is the vote to deregulate the airline industry.
Really?
I listened to Brock Adams and the Carter administration on that. I wish I could take that back because, the airline industry today discriminates against communities like this. They will charge an arm and a leg on routes where they have, dominance.
Yep.
And then, they go bankrupt about every other year. I mean, you can make an argument that the airline industry is the biggest welfare case in the country, because they've gone bankrupt so many times. And then every time they've gone bankrupt, they've gone after their employees, they've cut down their benefits, they've cut down their wages. I wish I had that vote back.
You did. Okay. You you worked with seven governors. Who was the most effective?
Well, Well, when you say I worked with, I was only in the legislature.
I know, but as a member of Congress, you would check back with everybody from Lucy Schreiber, Dreyfus Earle, Tommy McCallum, Governor Doyle.
Well, my fondest memories of my work in the legislature were the work that we did with Warren Knowles.
Warren Knowles.
Not because Mr. I think Lucy's he was the best governor. He was a very decent person, and his brother Bob was terrific in the state Senate. But in the 65 session, Warren Knowles is the governor, a Republican. Democrats controlled the state assembly. Republicans controlled the state Senate. And we got more done in that session than any session in my memory. It was terrific. And I was able to work with Republicans like Jerris Leonard and Bill Steiger and Dave Martin and Earl Mackesy and Bob Knowles. And we had some humongous fights with Governor Warren Knowles. But in the end, after we had the fights, the kind of politics I believe in is you define your differences between you and your opponent, and having defined those differences, then you look for ways to resolve them. That's the way you move forward. And so I loved that session we spent in the legislature. I think the guy who had the toughest hand dealt to him was Tony Earle, because when Tony took over as governor, on inauguration day, he was facing the fact that the state couldn't pay its bills that week. Right. So he had to ask the legislature on that day to go in and pass a tax increase so that they had money in the coffers to pay their bills. And that was it. Yeah, I mean, so and then the Republicans, who had been in power before that, you know, they called him Tony the Taxer because he met his responsibilities and had the state pay its bills. Pat Lucy, you know, every time I hear people say, oh, Democrats are anti-business, I want to gag, because there is no governor in the history, at least in the modern history of the state, who was more constructively pro-business than Pat Lucy. Pat Lucy pushed through a lot of changes in the tax code to be more favorable to business. He never got the credit that he should have, but he was a very business friendly governor, and he didn't feel that you had to rip up what you did for other people in society in order to accomplish it.
Every 10 years, you and Jim Sensenbrenner would get together and draw the lines for boundaries for members of Congress. Who's going to do it this year? You're gone. Well, should the Democrats worry?
The first time, it was Bill Steiger and me. Uh-huh. And we lost a seat that year. We went from 10 seats to 9. And so what we said was, well, it's going to be very difficult, but having said that, let's at least try to draw a map which does not appear to be aimed at upsetting the politics of districts to benefit one party or another. Mm-hmm. Let's try to be as neutral as possible on the politics and just react to the fact that we're going to lose a seat. And so what Bill and I did is we agreed that neither one of us would sit with each other to draw a plan, that we would each draw up a plan independently and then sit down with each other, turn them over, and see how close they were to resembling what the other guy did. And when the day we produced those maps, the maps were virtually identical, except for Barron County and Chippewa County. Those two those two counties have been handled differently. And that told me that we'd done a pretty good job being politically neutral on the subject. And ironically, what essentially happened in that reapportionment is that my district was eliminated because the 7th district was in the center of the state. Right. And by losing a seat, the eastern part of the district was taken by the 8th. The southern part was taken by the 3rd and the 6th, mm-hmm. and the northern part was taken by Alvin Okonski's old 10th district. So a little piece, you know, pieces of my district went in about four different directions.
Well, do you think Democrats should worry now that the GOP controls the governor's office, the Senate, and the Assembly?
Well, obviously the potential is there to be very biased because one party is in control of everything. I believe that when two parties are in control, I think it's best for the parties to work the issues out themselves, because that's part of the act of governance. Mm-hmm. But when one party is in control, then I think there is no likely possibility that you're going to have any political neutrality on these issues. Okay. And that's when I think you really ought to have a citizens commission that draws the lines.
You've had an amazing career. Are you writing a second book to kind of summarize it?
No,
you're
no.
Not.
One book is quite enough.
What's a fair way then to shortly describe your 41 years in Congress?
I don't know. Everybody will have to decide that for themselves. I hope that people simply will remember the fact that I showed up for work every day, and that there was never any doubt about whose corner I was in. I was always, to the best of my ability, in the corner of average working people, because they're the ones who pay the bills. They're the ones who make this country go. Just because they've been unlucky with health care or other aspects of life doesn't mean that they shouldn't get a helping hand so that they can have a life as decent as the life of people who've gone through life like they've, you know, as though they've been lucky all their lives.
Dave Obey, thank you so much for a walk down memory lane and recounting the big part of history that you've been a part of. Thank you.
Thank you.